Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today, retired Eli Lilly and Company CEO John Lechleiter and his wife Sarah want you to think of science as playful. But first up, for more than two decades, the Arts Council of Indianapolis has commemorated the official beginning of the fall arts season with a luncheon gathering of more than 1,200 business and arts leaders. I invited Arts Council of Indianapolis President Dave Lawrence to tell me about this year's event and also about what the recent Americans for the Arts Economic Impact Study revealed.
We are so excited. September 1st, new location this year at the JW Marriott.
I know, that's exciting. Did we just outgrow the old space?
No, they are renovating the Indianapolis Marriott downtown, so the ballroom is not available. So we're excited to be at the JW, and we are extremely excited to welcome our keynote presenter this year, Mandy Gonzalez, who has appeared here on the Cabaret stage with the Cabaret, who is our partner in bringing Mandy here in a new partnership. Mandy is currently starring on Broadway in a little show called Hamilton. I don't know
I
if you've heard of that.
Maybe heard of that. Yeah.
She is Angelica Schuyler in that performance, in that production. So we're really excited to welcome her here. And she's going to sing as part of her keynote presentation.
And she's going to be at the Cabaret that night.
Absolutely.
And the night before.
And the night before, right. So our sponsors are going to get a very special opportunity on August 31st to come and hear her and meet her prior to her performance at Start With Art. And we have heard that she's now been cast in the film version of Lin-Manuel Miranda's In the Heights.
In the Heights? Awesome.
That will start filming either later this year, beginning of 18. So her star will continue to rise. And she's got a really incredible story about how she got to Broadway and, you know, sort of what it takes to be an artist in 2017. So we're really excited for her to be here and to share her story with all of us.
And what's amazing about the Start With Art luncheon every year is, number one, how big it's grown. It is has been for some time the largest business and arts event in the country.
Yes, it's one of the largest in the country and has been for several years. So we'll have, close to 1,200 folks there to hear the mayor, who we always say is one of the biggest arts cheerleaders in the city. And it's going to be an incredible event. And one of my favorite parts is always the announcement of our Artie Award winners, where we recognize and celebrate those corporations and businesses and individuals who've really made a difference in the arts. And it's always important to thank and recognize those individuals for what they've done.
And the other aspect that I love is a kind of a variation on what you've just said, which is that half of the people who attend this are not artists. They are members of the corporate community, they're board members, they're people who believe strongly in the arts but maybe just don't make their living in the arts. And there is something intangible but very real about having artists and non-artists in the same room celebrating.
Right. You know, it's such a great mix of people. And, you know, we talk about that it's the annual family reunion of the arts, and all the arts organizations and artists are there. And it's good to see everybody because we've been busy during the summer planning our seasons and getting ready for all of that. But also then to have a room full of business leaders and civic-minded individuals who really understand and want to support the arts. So that mix is really, really exciting, which sort of led us to our thinking in terms of the theme this year, which is art rising. So we're looking at the concept sort of like an uprising. But what we're talking about is there's such a wonderful level of support and acknowledgement of the arts in our community. And we need to celebrate that, you know, celebrate the support that we get from the city of Indianapolis. And we have a very supportive city county council, and we thank them for their support, as well as the mayor and his support. And you know, corporate sponsorship is so important in this city. And so there's a lot to celebrate in terms of what the arts are doing. There's an article in the New York Times came out a few weeks ago about sort of we're in a second golden age of the arts in America. And so how we celebrate that and how we can continue to push forward those great messages of the impact of the arts is really important. And that's what we're going to talk about at Start With Art.
And that's just the kickoff. This is a theme our community is going to hear more about from the Arts Council and partners through the next year.
Right. We're really hoping that this concept of Art Rising will sort of begin sort of an advocacy and awareness campaign for the arts that we can all use to celebrate and talk about all the great things that are happening here in Indianapolis.
And one number that I think is always telling, we've just done the Every 5 Years Americans for the Arts survey.
Right. We, as you said, just completed this study for the last 5 years. So it is done every 5 years in conjunction with Georgia Tech and Americans for the Arts. We are one of, I believe it's 300 communities that participated this time in the study. And the number is astounding. $440 million of economic impact every single year just here in Marion County. And that is broken down into, you know, $227 million spent every year on direct spending by arts organizations. So, you know, paint the sets and paying our artists and musicians to perform, and everything else that is sort of those direct costs associated with it. But then an equally astounding number of $213 million is in exactly what you're talking about, sort of ancillary spending. You know, if you need a babysitter, that very important cocktail before the curtain goes up.
Parking,
dinner beforehand, all those sort of things contribute this. So the arts have such a multiplier effect in our economy. And it's incredible to see that every single year, almost $500 million is spent on the arts and cultural community here in Indianapolis.
Arts Council of Indianapolis President Dave Lawrence. This year's Start With Art Luncheon is Friday, September 1st at 11 o'clock, and you do need to pre-purchase tickets to attend. You can do that at indiearts.org, and that's also where you can learn about the newest Americans for the Arts Economic Impact Study, get involved in the Art Rising campaign, and find arts events as well. For 5 decades, the Penrod Society has staged its annual arts fair on the grounds of the Indianapolis Museum of Art. Tens of thousands of guests browse nearly 400 arts booths, watch performances on 6 stages, and meet friends new and old throughout the IMA campus. I invited Penrod Society Chair Dan Lechleiter and President Joe Hawkins to reveal how their corps of volunteers pulls off the annual Penrod Arts Fair. Remind us of why the Penrod Society actually got started.
So the Penrod Society was started in 1967 to really support what was then at the time the Indianapolis Art Association, which is what we know today as the Indianapolis Art Museum of Art. And at the time, there were some buildings and events out on what is today the IMA campus, but our goal in our initial inception was to support the growth and development of the organization into what we all know today as the IMA.
And you guys were sharing before we turned the microphones on that you recently met with someone from the IMA who was kind of blown away by the fact that at the first Penrod Arts Fair, there weren't even galleries at the IMA yet, right? The campus was that new?
Right. It was the original art fair was right on the front lawn, if you will, of Old Fields, which is the old Lilly Mansion there on the IMA grounds. And, yes, as they were reflecting all the new and exciting things that the IMA are doing now and into the future, as they looked at their past, they saw that, that the Penrod Society had been there before the galleries were there. And it sort of blew them away that they had people supporting their mission before they existed in a physical space.
And somewhere along the line, it became such a successful event, you decided to, you, plural, your predecessors, decided to share the money with many of the other arts organizations as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's
primarily now. We still do support the IMA in a large way, but also it's arts organizations and arts programming throughout Central Indiana. So not just what you would think of as performance organizations, which are wonderful in our community, but also taking art to where art may not be. So working with the Julian Center on art therapy, same mm-hmm. with the Riley Hospital, as well as things like the Jamison Camp, which is a day camp for disadvantaged youth during the summer, School on Wheels, and many other things as well. So it's not just what you would buy a ticket and go to, but bringing art to the community as a whole.
That makes it feel even better because it's always such a treat to go to the art fair and 300 visual artist booths and nearly 100 arts organization booths and 6 stages and everything to eat and drink. How many people are behind the scenes making this magic happen? And do you have – you don't have any paid staff, do you?
No, we don't. So we are an all-volunteer organization. We have no paid staff, no executive director. Our officers and leadership, we all have day jobs, and just about all of us have families and other demands. But I think for us, the Penrod Society and the Penrod Arts Fair is a way to give back to the community in a significant way, but also have a lot of fun with some of our best friends putting on the events that serve as our vehicle for supporting the community each year.
Do you reach out beyond the Penrod Society current membership for other volunteers?
We do. Many community volunteers come and work at our gates welcoming our patrons to the fair. Others work in the food and beverage area, selling water and sodas and things like that. A lot of students from surrounding universities also come and help out as well, which is always greatly appreciated. So, yeah, it's a true community event.
In the last few years, you've developed this wonderful sneak peek the night before. Tell me about what that's going to be like this year.
This year is going to be just, I think, probably the best yet. This will be our 5th annual. It's the Merchants Bank Evening at Penrod, presented by TWG Development. So we, for the start, we have great sponsors for that event. But this year we're going to have a real exciting band out of New York City called Hollis Brown, which is sort of in the vein of like a Black Crowes.
Ooh.
So real good energy, a lot of kind of bluesy music there. We're also going to have a tethered hot air balloon ride that'll go off right near where the old Love statue used to be located outdoors. And so that'll actually, go up there. You can see downtown all over the IMA grounds and the riverfront. So it should be a really neat evening. We have over 20 restaurants coming in. So if those of you have been to Zubilation, it's sort of a mini version of that, much more intimate, with lots of great artists right there. You don't have to walk as far at our event as you do at the Zubilation. So we also have a number of open bars. Sangrita Saloon in Broderville is sort of our alcohol and bar sponsor this year, and they'll be making a lot of craft cocktails to be enjoyed as well. So it should be a great evening.
What's your favorite moment at Penrod? Is it the moment the gates finally close and you can say, "Yay, we did it again," or is it the anticipation? Or
for me, it's that early morning. We get there super early, and kind of the 3:30 in the morning.
Oh, golly!
It is that anticipation. It's the calm before we get to the hustle and bustle of the gates opening and all the great patrons coming through and enjoying it. You can't beat just walking around at the fair and seeing families there with kids running all over the place, hearing all the music and the hustle and bustle of the whole thing.
Yeah, and I would very much agree with Joe. My favorite moment each and every year is the moment when on the radio we call for the gates to open. For the first folks who get there, really make the effort to get there early in the morning to be the first ones in, they almost two-step it in because they're so excited to see all that we have. And I think for us, it's just so gratifying to know that all this work we put in for the last 365 days is now coming to fruition, and folks are going to be there to enjoy it.
The Penrod Society's Dan Lechleiter and Joe Hawkins. Send them and their hundreds of volunteers your good energy vibes as they prepare for the 51st annual Penrod Arts Fair on Saturday, September 9th from 9 to 5. And don't forget the evening with Penrod the night before, Friday, September 8th, from 6 to 10:30. Learn all the logistics at penrod.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Coming up, Bath Bomb Lab, Little Bits Electronics Kits, and Tin Can Robots. Those are just a few contemporary toys aimed at getting kids interested in science. The Indiana State Museum provides a journey through the history of science at play. But first, Jolene Katzenberger talks with Joshua Gonzalez about the new cocktail menu at Thunderbird.
So we are talking today with Joshua Gonzalez of Thunderbird in Indianapolis. Thank you so much for talking with us today. So we're talking cocktail culture. You have been behind the bar. You're now an owner.
Yeah.
So you have seen all of this.
I've seen all that come go. So what we did with the new menu, I'm actually really excited about this. I came to the crew about a month ago, and I was like, guys, it's about going to be time for us to change the menu. I'm kind of tired of this process. I want to do something very different than what we've done in the past. And it's an idea we've kind of toyed with before, but we never really fully committed to it. So I said, I just want to do bad drinks, like drinks from the 80s that like that
talking,
we used to drink.
You're talking about like silly retro older drinks, you know?
Yeah, so I was like, let's write a list down of cocktails that I used to order at bars when I was 21.
Back in the day.
Right? Back in the day, in the late 90s. That you know, that you don't really see anymore. Like, what is Alabama Slammer? And I don't have SoCo or like Peach Schnapps. Like, what am I going to do?
Sorry. Oh no, Peach Schnapps.
I don't
schnapps.
Have those,
what am I going to do?
Ingredients.
So this is kind of fun. So instead of like working on, you know, the next big innovative serious menu, you kind of
I just wanted to have fun.
Turned it around and
yeah, we're doing a Singapore Sling. We're doing a Rum Runner. We've got Mudslide. That's incredible.
But you know. But there's a reason why people ordered those drinks.
Because they're fun, right? Like, they're fun drinks. Like, I like a Mudslide. It's a good cocktail.
That's kind of funny.
Yeah, it tastes like, you know, who doesn't want to drink something that tastes like, you know, chocolate, coffee, milk? But, so we're doing a Mudslide. We've got a Hurricane. We've got Blue Hawaiian.
Oh, my goodness. So these are things they look like you're going to open up a cocktail book and see all these colorful pictures, you know, blues and greens and oranges.
And that's exactly what we did.
So you have a very colorful menu now.
It's gorgeous. It's pastels, all the cocktails. And some by design, but more sort of a happy accident that all the drinks turned out to be these like beautiful pastel colors. And so we're doing Miami Vice themed. We're like the whole bar is getting tricked out in Miami Vice gear. Posters of Crockett and Tubbs ordered.
So if you're going to wear, you're going to wear a pink tie or something
like that?
Yeah,
the bartenders are committed to it. I hit them up last night late and I was like, hey, you guys, are we going to be dressing up for this? And everybody's like, yeah, we've already got gear ready to go. I was like, oh, okay, I guess I need to get on board.
That's right. You need to get that linen suit, and the pastel tie.
But I also want to do summer drinks. I was like, I hate the seasonality aspect of cocktails. I was like, let's do summer drinks in the fall.
Oh, okay.
So that's why, you know, we've got pina colada that's amazing, strawberry daiquiri.
Goodness. Oh, my goodness.
So we're actually going to be serving the original Miami Vice cocktail, which is a blend of pina colada and strawberry daiquiris blended together.
So this is fun. So this is to keep up your interest and your staff's interest and
I think
and
it was actually a really
interest.
Cool process for the staff, giving them like reverse engineering drinks, right? So we looked up all the old recipes online. A lot of them are just, you know, an ounce of orange juice, an ounce of grenadine, an ounce of some kind of flavored vodka. And so it was like, how do we create these flavors using what we have in-house? It was great. Like everybody came to the table. They really put on the creative hats and were really thinking and challenging themselves, making some really amazing syrups. We've got this beautiful coffee syrup we flavored with some star anise.
Is this
clove
for the Mudslide?
For the Mudslide, yeah. So we're using tequila and mezcal, and so, but the flavors are brilliant. Mike, who's new to our team, and he's just been a great ball of energy. He made this really phenomenal blackberry Jamaican spiced syrup. It's just incredibly delicious for our Rum Runner. Yeah, I've got this beautiful passion fruit honey syrup for the pina colada. We're making our coconut cream in house.
Okay, now see this sounds, you know, this is like a pina colada only better.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, so I made a vanilla syrup. It's spiced with some clove and cinnamon, and then blended that with coconut milk, fairly heavily salted too.
Yeah,
but it's delicious. Yeah, and then you know the strawberry daiquiri. We went down and grabbed a bunch of fresh strawberries from market. Made a delicious syrup, and that's spiced with some ancho chili. So, they're
nice.
The old school drinks done in Thunderbird style.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indie Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2 The Point. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and coming up, Georgia Buchanan teaches us how to age with grace and vigor. But first, a new commission multimedia exhibit at the Tube Factory showcases the work of former Indiana artist Larissa Hammond and New York-based poet Ariana Rines. WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer is here to tell us more. Tell me, this is intriguing.
It is, and Larissa now lives in Oregon, where she's been producing very structured art since she graduated with an MFA from the Pacific Northwest College of Art back in 2012. But a brain injury 2 years ago changed everything about her life and including her art. I met her at the Tube Factory to see her work and to learn more about her process, and she says that the first step in healing was journaling. So for 2 years, she took daily notes of what was going on inside her mind and her body, and as part of her installation, she recorded those writings using different audio levels to emphasize her feelings.
And again, I saw the slave bending over, standing up, in agony, body on fire. body is the fire, and with freedom comes the ability to transform outside the confines of a body inflamed.
It's writing that I've done over the last maybe 2 years. I started like a daily writing practice. I was really ill. I had my immune system attack my brain. I was learning language again, to talk again, how to move my body again, and a way that I did that, was able to build those things up again, was through writing. I really needed it.
The 30-year-old also needed some artistic encouragement, so she started a conversation with New York-based astrologer and poet Arianna Rhines. Now, that dialogue helped Larissa take a closer look at her family roots, which are grounded in the country of Trinidad.
I come from a culture where there's a very heavy maternal influence. The way that the cultures ended up mixing in Trinidad, I was told by my aunt, it was led by women. Trinidad is a very mixed culture. People are mixed, like African, East Indian, Chinese. What was explained to me by my aunt, I did not read this in a book, was that women led it, because those people who immigrated from China and India, they didn't want to be in a traditional role. They wanted, you know, to step out. So that kind of, helped with the culture of diversity there. So
Larissa says that knowledge influenced her greatly when she was able to get back to creating art. And this time she found herself painting. It's a skill that was completely new to her. In fact, she showed me her first work of art, which is a 6-foot painted linen scroll.
I didn't know what side of the canvas to use. I didn't know like what paints to get. Like, I just like went to the store, like, you know, got the stuff or whatever, and I just went at it. And when I was painting, I wasn't thinking like, I'm going to paint this and then I'm going to paint this. It was very much about, I was experiencing a lot of vertigo at the time. I was, you know, having a lot of brain issues and issues with coordinating my body. And to have a canvas that's like 5.5 meters long, and my body, I could lay on it. I could, you know, move how I could move that day. You know, I could put that motion into it, and it became, I wasn't using my eyes. I was using feelings of motion and my peripheral vision to evaluate densities. And then forms kind of started coming through. They're watered down acrylic, so it's lots and lots of thin layers. And then just stuff started coming out, and I just would look for it. And as it would come, I would kind of just emphasize it a little more and more. And it was just, an exercise in seeing more than painting.
Her exhibit includes 3 of those large-sized canvases. She started each one with a layer of gold paint and then added shades of yellow and brown to create figures and textures, and then added touches of white, red, and green to parts of the canvases. And then the main canvas also includes words that were from her conversations she had with Arianna.
I thought painting was so stupid. Like, when I was in school, I thought it was the dumbest thing, but I get it now. Like, I get it, and I love it. And, you know, as long as I can, as long as I have the resources to, I really, really want to paint.
And she knows those resources are in constant motion as her immune system makes adjustments, both good and bad, every day.
I'm doing a lot better. I mean, I have stuff every day, and that's okay. It's like I have to work a completely different way now. I have had to learn how to utilize a completely different part of my brain. I can't do the same things that I did before, but that doesn't mean that I can't do anything. I can do this, and I did this, and I'm really, really stoked. I didn't know if I was going to be able to finish it. It was a huge risk. I didn't know if I would be able to deliver, and all these people believed in me, and I did it, and I'm just really proud. And the way that I did it was by not pushing. Actually, it was by relaxing and listening to my body and being nice to myself and learning how to mother myself, learning how to basically raise myself again. When you're learning how to walk again and how to eat again and how to talk again and all that stuff again, you get to be your mom. Like, you, when you're 30 and that happened, or 29, 28, however old I was, you get to be your own mom, and it's age appropriate to be a mother at that age too. And so I really, it's interesting, like, being the mom and the daughter at the same time. But it was cool because I got, you know, some things that I wanted to maybe learn a little bit differently, I got to teach myself. And it's a cool power that we humans have to create our own lives.
Now, remember, the mission of the Tube Factory Museum Space is to curate based on themes of community, place, memory, and mythology. And Sharon, this exhibit hits on all of them. And I think what is most remarkable about it all is that Larissa really offers up what true art therapy is. She just created her own art therapy without even trying to. So once again, another intersection of science and art and how it's really helping a lot of people. And her exhibit is up through October 21st. It's at the Tube Factory, which is down there near Garfield Park. They're open every day except Sunday, and it's part of the Big Car Collaborative. So you can go to bigcar.org to get specific directions and times of the show.
Fantastic. You know, the arts are at the intersection of so many interesting things, and I think we have a few of them on that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
Well, here's a fun intersection. So in my day job, I work at Indiana Landmarks, and we do regular tours of the catacombs under the City Market. They sell out regularly because even though it's just a dirt basement with vaulted ceiling, people are fascinated by it. So if you're a music fan and you fell in love with Sarah Grain and the Billions of Stars on our small studio session, guess what? They're doing an album release party in the catacombs. You'll want to save some energy when you go to the Penrod Arts Fair because it is on Saturday, September 9th at 8 o'clock that evening. Just $10 to get in. Other bands, food and beverage. And once again, that's at the catacombs, an album release party.
And of course, Sarah Grain and the Billions of Stars, one of our small studio performers. So you can catch a sneak peek of her on the website, wfyi.org/small studio. That's not enough. Guess what? You can go to the indiearts.org/guide online. That's the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide and find more things to do. Or join us next week when we take a look at that calendar and we ask that question,
What'll we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Did you have a chemistry set when you were a kid? Playing with science is as relevant as ever. Stay tuned to learn why. But first, Georgia Giannakos Buchanan has overcome lots of obstacles in her life, beginning with learning English by collecting the newspapers that customers left behind in her father's downtown Indy restaurant when she was a young Greek immigrant. She's been a journalist, a philanthropist, the mother of a special needs child, and now she shares life lessons in her newest book. It's called How to Live Beyond 90 Without Falling Down. I invited her to talk about how her expectations of the golden years compare to the reality, and she began with a reading from the book's opening.
There are few things I have learned for sure. One, the seeds of a healthy old age are planted early in childhood and in teen years. Two, you can plan a roadmap of your life, but expect twists, turns, and turbulence. Three, your reaction to adversity has everything to do with your looks and lively steps in old age. Four, you can run from your life, but you can't hide from the added candles on your birthday cake. Five, nobody really escapes the aging process. However, bad habits can hurry it along. It is then paramount that you have and you pack a sense of humor on your life's journey.
Oh, boy, I think people of every age can relate to those words of wisdom. Now, I'm curious, you had
great relationships with your family growing up. You watched your family make a new life in this new country. Did you have thoughts as a child, as a teen, as a young woman in her 20s setting out on a career? Did you have thoughts about what it would be like to be 2, 3, 4, 5 decades older?
Yeah, I think so. I think, as I pointed out in my book, my love of newspapers was born when I was a child.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just almost kind of an accident. And I think it was just my curiosity coming out that I wanted to read those papers. Even when I couldn't read them, I collected them and looked at the pictures. and I think that carried me on through life to the next step and the next step. Growing up on just a certain section of the city called the wrong side of the tracks, and back in the 20s and 30s, what was beyond the tracks maybe was the first kind of goal. And then beyond that, you go to school, and then what is beyond Indianapolis? What is beyond Indiana? What is beyond the United States? And in later years, that curiosity carried me in my 20s. I was curious about my parents' homeland.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Greece. That was my first trip to Europe.
Wow. You did a lot of things that, in retrospect, based on your autobiography and this new book, were really brave. Did you think of yourself as brave at the time when you graduated Shortridge and you went to the newspaper in town and said, I'd like a job?
I just thought that was the way to do it.
That's probably just as well, because you didn't have to say, okay, I need to screw my courage up because I'm about to do something.
I think I learned that again from my dad, that he taught us many lessons. I mean, leaving his country and starting new life, not only just, you know, in another part of Greece, but an entirely different country, a new environment, a new language. And I just thought he always said, you have to go after what you want and make a plan, which is exactly his plan was to own a restaurant. And I think I learned that from him, to go after what I wanted. And I knew I wanted to work on a newspaper. And, you know, I didn't really want to go to college until I found out I had to. That was kind of a blow.
Darn, I can't start my real life for 4 more years.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you thank yourself regularly for having heeded that advice.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, I'm sure you got chromosomes from your dad and certainly a mindset from your dad. One of my favorite stories about your dad that I'd like you to retell is you saw some people selling newspapers.
Yes. on race day, see, we lived on Washington Street, which was in the early 30s. Of course, it still is U.S. 31. That was the only way they got to the 500-mile track on Memorial Day. So we would stand out, everybody. We couldn't wait till race day to watch all the cars go by. And we would write down the license numbers of all the states, all the kids. And do you see that one? It's from Montana. Do you see that one? It's from Illinois. And kind of a game. Well, while this was going on, I noticed that the two newshawks were out in the middle of the street and saying, you know, read your papers, the, you know, drivers' names, their numbers on the, you know, the star, and they're selling them and going back and picking up more in this huge stack, you know, on the sidewalk. And then I saw where they were passing coins and the fellows were putting them in their pockets. And I thought, wow, they're making money, they're selling newspapers. Why can't I do that?
How old were you?
Oh, I must have been 8.
Okay.
I wasn't very tall. I can remember just barely being able to see the drivers in the car, hoping there was a passenger that I would give the newspaper to. And I had to go back and forth many times because I couldn't carry very many. The newshawks would carry 10 or 12, you know, and go in and out, weave throughout the traffic and everything. And so I would get a few at a time and run back and sell them, buy my paper, and they would kind of look at me, I'm sure, kind of startled. What is this young kid doing out in the middle of the street? Of course, it didn't help that my siblings and playmates were on the sidewalk yelling at me at the curb to get out of the street. But I did sell them, and I got, he gave me part of the coins when we were through, and then I kind of trembled. I thought, oh my gosh, look, I've got this money. Mm. So I raced into my dad's restaurant, and I showed him the money. Of course, he wondered where I got it, and I said, well, I helped him sell the newspaper. He looked at me sort of in a gasp and pointed his finger, and then he smiled, and he said, it's okay. He says, we won't tell Mom.
Now, if you're a child listening to this, we're not suggesting that you do anything sheepish regarding your parents, but I love this story because it's you just have been brave, brave, brave without knowing that that's what you were being.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's true. It's true. You sort of came with the equipment, I guess,
yeah.
You know. And you just got out there and did what you felt you wanted to do. And it really just goes back to my parents.
Georgia Giannakos Buchanan. Her new book is called How to Live Beyond 90 Without Falling Down. Try Indie Reads Books or Amazon.com for copies. As many years as president, CEO, and chairman of the board of Eli Lilly and Company, you likely wouldn't have heard John Lechleiter say science and play in the same sentence. But now that he's retired, Lilly Chairman Emeritus John and his wife Sarah have time to encourage new generations to consider learning more about science through kids' chemistry sets. They helped to bring the new exhibit Science at Play to the Indiana State Museum, and I invited Sarah and John to reminisce about their own youthful science experiences. Did you have any kind of science kit, engineering kit, tinker toys, anything that anything like the toys in this exhibition when you were growing up?
I absolutely did not, which is so interesting because I'm totally on the sort of the arts and humanity side of things, and my husband is the chemist. So we are opposites that attracted.
Certainly one of our sons, our oldest son, Dan, was a Lego builder and a tinkerer from the very beginning.
Oh, for sure.
And went
such
on to
fun. Yeah.
Get a
yeah.
degree in mechanical engineering. So we sort of met in the middle there.
Because he has the creativity. Engineers have to have creativity as well as that ability to manipulate things in space, right?
That's right. And I think looking back to when Dan was growing up, we used to go and get scrap wood from one of the hardware stores here, and he would build with it, and we let him do that. I mean, he was handier with tools by the time he was 12 years old than I was, and I think he would say his interest in engineering and science and his career today as a patent attorney traces back to the fact he was able to play. And I think the exhibit now that just opened, Science at Play at the Indiana State Museum, sort of extols the virtues of kids in particular learning science by doing and many times by playing.
Mm-hmm. What kind of science? Did you have a science kit or multiple science kits growing up yourself?
I had a great opportunity to dabble in science. One of the things that struck my fancy at the museum exhibit are all the old chemistry sets. Mm-hmm. And it turns out they were more or less replaced by Pac-Man in the early 1970s as gifts under the Christmas tree. They really went out of vogue in the 60s, but I remember getting two chemistry sets and being allowed by my parents to, quote, experiment out on the driveway, and they brought back wonderful memories and must have influenced me in some way as I decided ultimately to get a degree in chemistry.
There was a very explicit growth in these kits at a time when we needed people to acquire those skills, right?
Right. Right. It was the space race. It was us versus the Russians. It was the Cold War. And I remember quite distinctly from a very young age being told this country needs more scientists and engineers. And the high school I went to in particular, it was sort of cool to do science and math. We had science fairs and many, many of those students that were in high school with me went on to study physics and chemistry and math and engineering and it was part of the national sort of psyche at that time. Of course, we need those people today too.
Absolutely.
More than ever.
Yeah. I think back to chemistry labs and biology labs, but especially chemistry labs where the boys, this is a sweeping generalization, there were exceptions, of course. There were girls who did this too, but you know, the boys would read the instructions and then just say, "Well, what would happen if I just dumped all these chemicals in here at the same time?" You know. Usually no harm was done,
yeah, right.
But there's merit in that, right?
I think I do think there was a maturity level of the girls that probably was saying, hey, we'll follow the rules.
Yeah,
right, we're not gonna blow ourselves.
This is why there are two genders in the world. We balance each other out.
But, you know, a lot of science practiced in a laboratory setting, whether it's at a university or in a company like Lilly, it is trial and error. And sometimes you do find remarkable things through serendipity. And sometimes you have to be willing, you know, at times to play a bit and to break the rules and try something that may be unconventional. And I think that's the spirit of play. And I think at the at the museum right now, there are a number of stations where kids can build things. They can observe how chemical reaction takes place. And yeah, I think that's the beginning of fostering interest and imagination that's so important, regardless of what age you know you are as a scientist. It's for me, it was always fun and exciting to do science, and hopefully this will be part of getting more kids interested in that.
Sure.
Oh, I think so.
I sense that it's important to get people back to manipulating objects in actual time and space, in three dimensions, digitally.
This is one reason why museums are so important, because they are, even though we have more and more virtual displays and we use technology in our museums, it is an object-based experience. And I think there is something important, particularly in science, to the tactile, to the sensory perception of what's changing and what's happening as I do this experiment. So I think that's a great purpose served here.
Let's say you two were going to design a science kit for the future. What kinds of activities would you put in it?
Well, I'll let Sarah think about her answer. I think I would, when I was a kid growing up, the environmental science was in its infancy. And I think we're so much more aware of the environment and the impact of activities of daily living on the world around us. I think I would probably start by focusing on that, on the everyday experiences that kids can, you know, sort of see and be familiar with in their own home situation. I think that's a good and useful angle. And of course, you know, anything related to medicine, I think is interests would interest anyone. I remember always having to explain, you know, why am I taking all these science courses if I'm going to be a doctor, and do I really need them? And I think that it's important, you know, to understand what those basic principles are that ultimately determine how our bodies work and how disease takes its course and how we can hopefully reverse some of that.
Because I really never experienced a science kit, you know, that just wasn't where I was coming from. But I guess I did other things. I loved, I would think it would be great fun for a child to have the ingredients to make Play-Doh themselves or, you know, to experience that. And this isn't exactly science, but I think it's sort of when you take something or you take sort of a lot of somethings, which you might say by themselves would be nothing, mm-hmm. but when you put them together, they become something like magic. And I think that would be fun for a child. So, you know, it's just sort of mundane things. And I think often when a child is given the opportunity to observe, say, someone like yourself, John, you know, doing something in the classroom with children, and they always seem to pick, you know, the hard-boiled egg going into the
bottle.
And I just think anytime you can put together a scenario like that where kids are sort of, they're amazed in some way, and then it makes them think, wow, you know, life is really can really be fun and interesting. I really was amazed by this exhibit when I saw it in Philadelphia. And, you know, again, and I had no background in this, but you just can't help but appreciate and get excited about it. And in a way, I felt like I missed something in my childhood. So there we go.
Yeah. I think kids are just naturally curious.
Curious, yes.
And there's so many ways to make science relevant to their world and to help them understand, you know, why is grass green and why do stars shine in the sky and what are those things anyway? Someone was telling me the other day there's an app that will orient you to look at the night sky to help you find the various constellations, and I thought, well, I've got to get that.
Sarah and John Lechleiter. And yes, they're the parents of Dan Lechleiter, from whom we heard about the Penrod Arts Fair earlier in the show. It was their son Dan who liked to play and invent with Legos. Revisit your own childhood or inspire a new generation at the Indiana State Museum, where you can see science at play through January 15th. Learn more at indianamuseum.org. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. Rock and roll musician Nina Diaz joins me today, and she's going to share five songs with us. You can catch Nina in Indianapolis Saturday, August 19th. She'll be participating in an all-ages girls rock workshop from 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. at Tarkington Park. And later that night, you can find Nina at the Melody Inn. Nina Diaz began performing music at age 13 in San Antonio, Texas, when she joined her older sister's punk band, Girl in a Coma. We're going to listen to Ven Cerca by Girl in a Coma as Nina describes the process of finding her voice as a young musician.
When I first started singing, I just sang because I liked it. You know, I liked the way it felt. I liked the way it felt with my energy, because I was just a very emotional kid. And, you know, they say, yell it out, scream it out, write it out. And I just kind of gravitated doing that kind of a thing. I wasn't listening to myself and thinking, wow, you're something different here, Nina. I was just thinking of, I think I'm keeping a good melody. I think that I'm in key. And, you know, as I got older and as I got more confident, I started to realize that I do have a different voice.
Up next, we're going to listen to Girl in a Coma's cover of Si Una Vez by the late Tejano singer Selena.
I am not fluent in Spanish. You know, I come from a lazy generation, and I am now trying to make up for it in any way possible, and it's on my list of things to do before I die, to be fluent in Spanish. But I do my darndest to sing it, and Selena is the best entryway of me as a performer and a singer to sing songs in Spanish, and Si Una Vez was, as soon as we heard it, we thought we can make this one like definitely punk sounding, so that's what we got. Yo te digo mi amor y más, y tú no reconoces lo que es amar. Yo me puse después de tus pies y tan solo con desprecio más pagado de la hora de. Nina's debut solo LP, The Beat Is Dead, was released in 2016. The album details Nina's journey from addiction to sobriety. And up next, Nina's going to tell us about the track January 9th. Well, yeah, January 9th, 1998 was the year and the day that my grandmother passed away. I was 10. I was very close to my grandparents on my mother's side, both of them. And I always felt my grandparents' presence around me, my grandmother, especially before my grandfather passed away. And then when my grandfather joined her, when I was in the midst of my addiction, I was working on this song, January 9th. And before I knew I was going to call it January 9th, I was working on this melody. And I just felt this very intense, strong energy around me that it scared me. But I know that it was my grandparents kind of starting to tell me, you have to stop doing drugs. You have to stop. You're going to die.
Every time I try. I scream your name. Every time I try to walk away, I stay the same. Oh, in the back of my mind, in the back of my mind.
And next we're going to listen to another track off The Beat Is Dead titled Rebirth.
Rebirth, I got a loop pedal when I first started doing a lot of my solo stuff. I mean, we started using the loop pedal with Girl in a Coma for sound, but then I really started to write. Because when you have a loop pedal, you know, you can write by yourself. You just put one little melody, and then you can stack another and another. And I had a Boss loop station. And I don't know, this melody just came out of me. And if you really, really listen to this song, it's very simple. It's like a mantra kind of a song.
Finally, Nina will tell us about the 1980s-inspired production on the song Young Man.
With the synthesizers, and that, like you say, that 80s new wave kind of element. I love Depeche Mode, you know. I love the darkness of Depeche Mode, and I like to think that I kind of got that energy, that vibe with Young Man and with Screaming Without a Sound. I feel like I, in my mind, I kind of tried to capture something somewhat similar.
Many thanks to Nina Diaz. You can check out more of her music online at ninadiazmusic.com.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 8 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Jill Dittmeyer. You can hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, the Butler Arts Center has some surprises planned. The cabaret is no longer itinerant, and Rob Dixon recorded a small studio session just for us. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.